Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who have come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, we feature Rabbi Zach Kamenetz on the topic of psychedelics and the future of Judaism. Kamenetz is the former director of Jewish Living and Learning at the JCCSF, and he is the founder and executive producer of the Shefa Podcast Network. In 2017, he participated in an experiment at Johns Hopkins University, where he was given two major doses of psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms. The mystical insights he absorbed convinced him that psychedelics, such as LSD and magic mushrooms, will not only alter the entire course of mental health treatment, it will fundamentally change the way we think about Jewish religion and spirituality. And now, Rabbi Zach Kamenetz.
So, psychedelics and the future of Judaism. I was honored enough to be part of a study with Johns Hopkins University in 2017, where they had 20 clergy people be part of this study through the behavioral sciences section of Johns Hopkins. And they gave these 20 clergy two high doses of psilocybin. That is the active psychedelic compound within magic mushrooms, psilocybe mushrooms. And they wanted to understand what is the nature of consciousness for someone and a group of people who have access to a particular vocabulary and understanding of the world. They are involved in spiritual matters. They are guiding or counseling or serving as pastoral role for other people with regard to religion and spirituality. What would happen if we gave these mind-altering, mind-enhancing, soul-enhancing compounds to these people, and what might they be able to say about their inner experience that would help us understand not only what is the effect of these things on people in general, but what is the mystical quality of them? So we'll talk about what mysticism is, we'll talk about what psychedelics means, we'll talk about a number of these technical things. And this, I also want to take the opportunity right now to say that in no way through any of my writing or through my presenting today, am I advocating for the illegal or the illicit misuse of any sort of drug that is federally scheduled as a drug that could have legal ramifications. What I'm talking about is in the context of scientific research. Anything that I'm talking about is after the fact, after these compounds and plants become decriminalized in some cases, legalized in some cases, allowed for expanded access for healthcare, and not for the purpose of people taking these substances on their own. But if people are going to, then at least they have more information and that it is a matter of harm reduction. But that's up to people, but not my personal advocacy for this work. I want to mention some of the terms to be used. I've already used the word psychedelic a couple times, but I probably will be using the word entheogen much more frequently throughout the conversation tonight. And we'll talk about what those things are and where those terms come from. I also want to talk about what a mystical experience is, just so that you know you might have a different interpretation or a different definition, or you might have no definition. But for you to know where I am coming from with the use of a word like mysticism, and not to have it be an assumption that we all know what mysticism is, we all know what psychedelics are and what they do. So to have kind of that baseline. And I also want to mention what integration means with regard to psychedelic research and psychedelic therapy. So just a little bit of history. The word psychedelic was coined by a person at a particular time in 1956 by Dr. Humphrey Osmond from England. He was one of the first people who was doing clinical research with psychedelics. I believe it was LSD. And he coined this term before there were many other terms that were being devised or created by people who were working with these things. But this one kind of stuck because the word itself is made up of these two words, psyche and delein, which means either mind or soul manifesting. And the intent here then is that once you imbibe a particular chemical or a particular plant, that something about your mind rises up from inside you, and it is therefore more manifest than it had been before. So that is the term psychedelic, and it means any psychoactive substance when consumed, which causes these changes in our perception, which might even cause visual hallucinations, but not all of the time, meaning that there is something that you are seeing with your eyes, perceiving in your visual field, that might not necessarily be there unless you had taken this substance. And you might have a altered sense of your body, meaning my nose is as large as the house, or my mind. For example, I am going crazy, or I feel like I am the savior. You know, I am the savior of humanity for 6 hours or so. So that is what psychedelic intends. But we know from more recent research and usage that there is another term that is being used much more often, and that is entheogen. Entheogen was coined by one of the most notable researchers and mycologists of the 20th century named R. Gordon Wasson. He was one of the first people to write about his experiences under the effect of these magic mushrooms that we'll talk a little bit about later. He and his wife actually traveled to Mexico to try to find the famed curandera medicine woman named Maria Sabina. And he and his wife sat in one of her shaman circles. And they had been mycological enthusiasts for years and had heard that there were these varieties of mushrooms that could actually give you these hallucinatory, deeply spiritual experiences. And then what he found was her and these mushrooms, and he coined this term entheogen, coming from these two words, entheos and genesthai, meaning that not only is it different from psychedelic, where it is manifesting something about your mind, but there is a holy, sacred dimension to these things, not merely just on the level of psychology or consciousness, but you're actually manifesting the divine, entheos, the divine within, that there is a divine nature, there is a godly quality that can be revealed or uncovered by taking these things, taking these plants. And he says in one of his papers, only those vision-producing drugs that can be shown to have figured in shamanic or religious rites would be designated entheogens. So probably LSD, which was created in a laboratory in the 40s in Basel, Switzerland, maybe Wasson would not have considered an entheogen because it did not have this shamanic medicine history of indigenous people, but that might be debated today. This is all to say that when we talk about entheogens, or at least when I talk about entheogens, this is not merely a drug that one would go to a party or go to the woods and have a really great time or maybe a terrible time, but this is part of an uncovering of some holy aspect of the world or ourselves, our relationship with the divine, and entering into a relationship then with this plant or chemical to kind of further that, to go somewhere, to get somewhere in someone's spiritual or religious journey or development. Now, what is a mystical experience? People talk about religiosity, spirituality, and mysticism, and we don't always have some shared terms about what that means. So I wanted to share this definition of what a mystical experience is. This is William James. He's one of the first great scholars of religious phenomenology, meaning not just where does a religion come from or where does a religious text or practice come from, but what is happening when people who claim to have part of a religious tradition, what is happening in that community, in the mind of the practitioner and the phenomenon of being a religious person. And he published one of the hallmark texts of this scholarship, Varieties of Religious Experience, in 1902, where he himself had been experimenting with his own consciousness. He had been taking laughing gas, He had been inhaling this nitrous oxide, and he had noticed that there was something different about his consciousness when inhaling nitrous than when he was not taking it. And he wrote it this way: "Our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness. Whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different." So he was able to tell that he entered into a different way of being than he was when he was just waking up in the morning, having breakfast, teaching his university classes, or doing his writing, when he took something from outside himself, a psychedelic or an entheogen, here just nitrous gas, and that there was something unique about this mind consciousness, this altered state that was different. And he would say there are not just two, not just altered and non-altered, but he would say there are many ways that our consciousness exists in our lives. And we usually just only talk about the one when we are in our waking state. And so he wanted to understand what religion and spirituality meant with regard to consciousness. So this is what I mean, that there is a special type of consciousness that we will not totally get into immediately, but a little bit later, about what is an expanded state of consciousness when talking about psychedelics or entheogens. But just to know, mystical means beyond our normal waking consciousness. Some of the hallmarks of mystical awareness or consciousness that might make it different from our waking state are a number of them. And these are just a couple of them, but there probably are many more. And according to different traditions or lineages or practices, there might be many, but these are some of the most common ones. And these were some of the most common that came up when I was at Johns Hopkins. I took a very long battery of questionnaires after the fact, and they wanted to know something about my mystical awareness. And they asked me many questions about these hallmarks. Did I have this kind of experience? Was it this kind of experience? And these were the ones that they focused mainly on. They are unity, meaning that either the divinity that I experienced, if I experienced divinity at all, was unified in some way, right? It wasn't multiple entities and personalities, but there was some unified field around the sense that I felt that I was making contact with that divine presence. Or that I and the universe and all things and all people were also unified in some special way, more than just an idea or a concept or a value. Yes, we're all one. We're all one nation, or we're all one people, but to feel it as deeply as possible, as if it was a truth that was indubitable, that was inalienable to my life, something that I could not shake, and I felt in the deepest place in myself. So that is unity. The next is transcendence of space and time. It wasn't that I knew it was Tuesday. I knew that it was probably around 3 p.m., but I had kind of left the field of there being a concept of time, that I was on a couch in Johns Hopkins, but I felt as though I was nowhere and everywhere at the same time. I was beyond the strictures of how I usually run my day. I'm here at this time, I'm here in this place, I am here and far beyond, I am now and in the past and in the future. Something called intuitive knowledge, or as our dear friend William James would call, the noetic quality. Were there ideas? Were there things that I was perceiving or learning or coming to understand through my experience that then were so intuitive, it was as if they were just truths that I could not run from, facts that I could not hide from, something about my relationship with myself, or relationship with my body or my parents, my workplace, my spouse, my child, something about my religious tradition, a truth in the universe that was out there that I felt as if it had come from me, and that no one had to tell me. It's just something that came to me, maybe just from the beyond, but it was as if I had had the thought myself. So noetic, noesis, this kind of knowledge. The sacredness. It wasn't that it was like kind of cool, it was interesting, but that I felt as if I was in a holy place, a holy space, that the experience that I was having had the dimension of not being secular or, I would say, mundane, but something beyond this realm. Also a deeply felt positive mood. I would quibble with this one a little bit because I can say that I have had a non-positive mood, but in a deeply felt positive mood, that this is one of the most ecstatic, most wonderful things that can happen, an overwhelming sense of gratitude and excitement that it is happening, and that you are feeling it with every fiber of your body. And then finally, something about its ineffability, meaning that after the fact, or even during maybe, that it is very hard to capture with words, either spoken or in writing, about exactly what it is that I experienced when I was in that mystical state. What happened at various points throughout the trip or the journey? What is it that I could say that I saw, or even that I say that I learned or intuited? It might be difficult to explain, and that's why there is probably sometimes a gap, whether it happens because you take a plant, or you ingest a plant or a compound, or you have a naturally occurring mystical experience, something that just is generated endogenously from within you without anything external being taken. It's hard to then say to a friend, to a confidant, to a clergy member, to a parent, to a spouse, this is what it was like. And many people, of course, they recount this, that even though it was beyond real, it was beyond true, they still cannot find the right words to capture what it is that they saw or they felt. And that sometimes then makes talking about mysticism potentially a little bit embarrassing, because then you're stammering, you can't capture it, but you feel it intensely and deeply. It might be more easy to keep it to oneself. So these are some of these hallmarks of mystical awareness, at least for James and certainly for Johns Hopkins, amongst other research facilities who are doing this kind of work, where they want to know from 1 to 10, how was this an experience of unity? From 1 to 10, how much did you feel like you were in a sacred space? And I'll talk a little bit about where did this research come from? Most people probably have heard about psychedelics, they've probably heard about entheogens and have some idea about what plants and substances we're talking about. But I think that very few people that I encounter when talking about this know a little bit about the history of the research that was done in the 60s and 70s. So it started with two people, probably more, but at least two at Harvard. And those were Dr. Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert. Also, Richard Alpert became known as Ram Dass, the spiritual teacher. And these two people had encountered these magic mushrooms because of R. Gordon Wasson, the person that we talked about who coined the term entheogen. And Timothy Leary was so overtaken by the power of this plant, this mushroom, this fungus, that he said that what he experienced in just an hour under the influence of this fungus was more than he had ever experienced in years and years and years of psychotherapy. So he thought that the power and the potential for psilocybin was so great, and its impact on psychotherapy. They were both in the behavioral sciences department and psychotherapy departments in Harvard, that they decided that they would actually create something called the Harvard Psilocybin Project, where they would run a number of studies by giving grad students and volunteers psilocybin under controlled settings, in controlled settings, them as therapists, and to then study the experiences and the effects that people had while they were in this controlled setting.
You're listening to Rabbi Zach Kamenetz on psychedelics and the future of Judaism on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
One of the most famous studies was carried out by one of their research assistants named Walter Pankey. And Walter Pankey, it is said, with Leary and with Alpert, they designed something called the Marsh Chapel or Good Friday Experiment, where they took 20 graduate divinity students, I believe all Christian, and I believe mostly, if not all, male. And what they did is they gave half of the group psilocybin, and they gave half of the group something else. I believe it could have been niacin. And then to have them go on Good Friday, the Friday before Easter Sunday, into the Marsh Chapel on the Harvard campus. And they would have them be in the basement. So above ground, the Good Friday service would be carried out in the chapel, and the music and the sermon would be piped down in speakers for these 20 people in the basement in pews. And can you guess what happened? Half of the group had this overwhelming spiritual experience, and half of the group felt a little tingly for a little bit. So it quickly became very clear that the study design was very flawed, actually. It was not double blind, because people who received the psilocybin probably knew that they were getting the psilocybin. People who got the other compound, I think it was niacin, they knew that they were not doing whatever those other people were there when people were raising their hands and saying, "The Lord, the Lord, the Lord." So despite these design challenges, it inspired even more research, and it completely opened up the field in a brand new way. Not only because of some of the indiscretions of not only Timothy Leary, but also Richard Alpert, the Harvard psilocybin project had been closed down, and their funding was taken away. They were both fired from Harvard, but not even a decade later, Richard Nixon signed the Controlled Substances Act of 1971, making all of these drugs and all of these plants and fungi illegal, scheduled class one, meaning that the government had decided that they had no beneficial purpose for human beings, and they had no benefit to scientific study. And that meant that it was a felony to possess them, to grow them and cultivate them, and you would then have one of the harshest penalties because of your possession or cultivation of these things. And so because of this this act, many other countries followed in suit. The research here in this country, it continued in some places until the early 80s, but that quickly dried up after that, around the early 80s or so, and all around the world mostly, until very recently. Until. In 2008, Roland Griffiths, he published a landmark paper. He was a lead researcher. He is a lead researcher at Johns Hopkins University. And he published this paper entitled "Mystical Type Experiences Occasioned by Psilocybin Mediate the Attribution of Personal Meaning and Spiritual Significance 14 Months Later." What that means is that people who take high doses of psilocybin that are derived synthetically from magic mushrooms have experiences that are close to, if not completely, the same as a natural mystical experience. And it's hard to tell the difference between someone who takes a mushroom and someone who has a natural mystical experience. Not only that, but they have this person who takes psilocybin thinks that, feels that it is one of the most significant experiences of their entire lives. They don't have the numbers here, but I think it's roughly 80% of the people who had gone through the research that it took to publish this paper in 2008 said it was in their top five of most meaningful experiences of their entire life. And I believe 50% said that it was the number one greatest experience of their life. That's pretty significant to me. And this one paper has been basically the foundation for all sorts of studies, long-term meditators, what's happening in the minds of long-term meditators when they take psilocybin, people who have terminal cancer and their fear of death, people who are addicted to cigarettes, people who are experiencing OCD, people who are experiencing sexual trauma, et cetera. All of these groups are being studied in an ongoing way with regard to how psilocybin might actually change their life and their situation because of this one or two powerful experiences because of psilocybin. And then just to read the highlighted part here, psilocybin occasion experiences similar to spontaneously occurring mystical experiences and which were evaluated by volunteers as having substantial and sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance. The ability to prospectively occasion mystical experiences should permit rigorous scientific investigations about their causes and consequences. So much so that I was one of the first test subjects to not be studied for anything with regard to a mental health state or an addiction. This study that I was in, called the Religious Leaders Study, was not about me having, God forbid, terminal cancer, not about necessarily me having some mental malady or issue with my mental health that made it impossible for me to function as a parent or as a father or as an employee or as a leader in some way, but merely just to say, what is here? What is here for people who have this spiritual religious disposition, and what can we then know about the hard question of consciousness because of this? And what is the nature of mystical experience for people who have a vocabulary about the self and the soul in this particular way? So this was a little bit about my experience. I had a major assessment program that I was part of, many phone calls, many follow-ups. I went to Johns Hopkins. They now have dedicated an entire psychedelic research unit after millions and millions of dollars of donations and philanthropic dollars. It's not just in the behavioral sciences department. It is its own thing. These are some of my guides, the people who guided me through this process. They're healthcare workers, they're social workers, they're longtime psychedelics researchers who've been in the field for a long time. And for about 2 years, I had gone to Johns Hopkins about four times to be part of this study. I had been screened medically, psychologically, and personally. I was told that, you know, I knew that if I had had any sort of family history with mental illness, that I would not be a suitable match for this. If I had had my own issues with mental health, or if I was taking antidepressants or something like that, that I wouldn't be a good candidate for that, because there are still risks. So they understand that this might have a breaking effect, that there might be people who are predisposed to having some sort of mental health disorder, and this might just be the thing to push them into a place where they weren't before. So because of all of these reasons, it is not for everyone. And so not only now, but even in the future, whatever the advocacy and education work that there is to be done, it is not something that should be just given out freely, at least I don't think, because of the negative impact that it might have on a number of people. So in total, I spent 104 weeks as a subject of this study. This looks like someone's living room, but it really is a research facility. There are cameras in the ceilings. I believe that all of the sound is being recorded. There looks like there is a mushroom god on the left. There's a statue of the Buddha. There's a very comfortable couch. It's like, I would love to get this couch for my house. So comfortable. There's a very old stereo system that wonderful, beautiful music is being piped in into my ears. My eyes are covered. My guides are with me on the floor, or they're in their chair, and it is well appointed. It looks like an anthropologist professor's living room, basically. And I was on the couch roughly for about 7 to 8 hours. I was able to get up and go to the bathroom when I needed to. If I ever felt any sort of sense of overwhelm, or, you know, at one point I remember during my first session, I think I took off my earphones and I looked up to one of my guides and I said, "Is this forever? Like, is this what I do now? I'm here now and this is what it's like." And immediately someone came and took my hand and said, "You're not going to be here forever. this is happening to you right now. You've taken a very powerful drug, but this will be over in a couple hours. So all you need to do is turn inward, let go, and float down the river. And so if there ever was a sense that, you know, there was a rising anxiety about what was actually happening to me inside my mind and my heart, that there was always someone who was going to support me. But they were mostly just kind of backed off, took notes if I ever needed them. It was not like they were guiding me through some like meditation or guided imagery, but that they were there. They knew kind of the inner terrain. And I knew that if I needed anything, if I felt nervous or upset or scared, or just needed someone to walk me to the bathroom because the walls were moving, then they would be there for me. So, trip one. I won't talk very much about my direct experiences, but I will say that it was really typified by this kind of dynamic, overwhelming visual pattern. There was constant moving of light. It was always wonderful. It was always beautiful and powerful. It was awe-inspiring and inducing. I felt great gratitude to God and, you know, calling out again and again, thank you, thank you. Feeling as though I was moving through a tunnel, a canal at several points. I felt, you know, as if I was giving birth to my wife, who was giving birth to my daughter, and just, you know, crying and feeling completely overwhelmed by love and joy and gratitude. There was some Kabbalistics, there was some Jewish imagery there for me that I interpreted as having something to do with a particular life circumstance at that moment that I knew at that moment. That's what that noetic or intuitive knowledge was. What I was seeing and feeling had a direct impact, or it was teaching me something about a circumstance in my life that I knew that after I returned home, that I had to do something about it because of the thing that I was witnessing. If I had not seen that, I would not make the decisions that I would need to because of that circumstance. Overwhelmingly positive, beautiful, life-affirming, and I knew because it was such a great experience that the lead researcher said, okay, the next time you come back, you'll have more. Okay, so more must be better. No. More was not better. More was actually nothing. I would think that more psilocybin, the, you know, most powerful, pure grade, nothing wrong with it. It was created in a laboratory, that I would have had an even more exciting, even more exhilarating experience. But what I experienced for 6 to 7 hours was basically just blackness and boredom. I didn't know if I was going to be here on the couch forever in this dark hole. I felt very sad and depressed, like I had done something wrong, or I had done something in my preparation that did not give me access to, you know, higher realms of knowledge or insight, or even, you know, an audience with the divine in the same way that I had before. And it left me shaken. It made me feel as if I had been denied something very powerful. And it left me quite sad for a number of weeks after. So, you know, even when I was done and I expressed this to the lead researchers and my guides, they really didn't understand why it would be that, but everything is possible. So more does not mean better with psychedelics or anything. Turns out, maybe you probably knew that. I did not. And so the phase that came afterward is the phase called integration. If I had preparation before going to Baltimore, exploration while I was at the time, while I was on the couch, everything that happens after the fact is integration. And according to the Zendo Harm Reduction Handbook, this is an organization that helps people at festivals, music festivals, dance festivals, for people who are having psychedelic experiences that they might have taken too much, or God forbid, they didn't know that they were taking something, someone had given them something, or they're just having a hard time, they can go to these tents and there can be someone who is there guiding them, and it's a safe place for them to be. They feel safe, they feel taken care of. And they say that integration is the phase within which an individual assimilates and incorporates an experience into their psyche, body, and life. So 2 years later, this integration experience, I wrote it and in an article you can find online entitled, I Was a Rabbinic Psychonaut, where I said that my first session was a journey through the world of phenomena, light and color, relationships, emotion, and apprehension, the world of immanence. My second session was a journey into transcendence, beyond polarities and causality, to a place, as the writer Stanislav Grof describes, pregnant with all existence. So what I was going through then was, the first one was complete presence, complete color, complete obviousness of the divine and my place in the world. The second, which was maybe even the higher revelation, was everything beyond that. No light, no color, no presence, only absence. And that was not something to be to regret or to lament, but taken together, I came to understand something about the nature of my own religious life, is that there is presence and there is absence. And sometimes I prefer one over the other for obvious reasons. I want presence. I want to know that things are good. I want to know that things are there, that I can count on them. But if they aren't, that doesn't mean that I'm having less of an experience, that this is somehow a spiritual downgrade, but is just as potent with meaning if only I would see, if I would uncover something meaningful in it. That it was not absent of meaning, it was waiting for me to ascribe meaning to it. So, okay, you talked about psychedelics and entheogens. What about the future of Judaism? So here are two headlines from two different types of publications. In Scientific America, January 2020, not too many months ago, MDMA or ecstasy shows promise as a PTSD treatment. They're currently in phase three clinical trials, both in this country and in Israel, especially for this chemical, this substance. MDMA, you might know as X or ecstasy or Molly, other names, that people who are PTSD patients, either because they are soldiers or because they have gone through painful traumas in as children or as adults, sexual abuse, people who have experienced terrible suffering, are starting to find that there is great relief that happens in this clinical environment when they take MDMA with this kind of preparation, exploration, and integration model.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Rabbi Zach Kamenetz, speaking on psychedelics and the future of Judaism. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And now just May 2020, and Vice, get ready for pharmaceutical grade magic mushroom pills. So the thing that I experienced, magic mushrooms in a pill, that we are getting ready for another psychedelic renaissance if we haven't been in it already, but that these things are going to be made more and more available to people who are looking for them, not just to have a drug experience, but for people who are looking for some relief. The psychopharmacological model for so many people is not working. It has never worked for so many. For some it does, but people who have either had lifelong depression, who have tried to use antidepressants, SSRIs, and have never found relief, people who don't find relief through talk therapy, there might hold real promise for people. And that might just be the first phase of this, to actually show that there is great benefit for humans who are experiencing suffering. And when people can understand that there is something of benefit, not only for scientific research, but for actual people in an ongoing way, then it might open up to not people who are suffering from any immediate cause, but for people who are really just excited and interested in self-exploration and transformation for the betterment of well people, as one person has said, Robert Jesse, Bob Jesse. And so we are kind of on the precipice here about what is happening and what is possible. So what about for the future of Judaism? Well, I think that there are a number of things to talk about. And again, there's so much to say and so little time. But for me, truly, this is first and foremost what is to be beheld because of the research that is coming out, but also from the things that people are able to talk about anecdotally. And number one, I think on the agenda, if there is one, is that this is a call to rekindle our mystical heart. What does that mean? I love this quote from Leonard Cohen, who I think says it so precisely and succinctly. Judaism is a secretion with which an Eastern tribe surrounded divine irritation, a direct confrontation with the absolute that happened once in history, and we still feel the warmth of that confrontation, divorced as we are from the terms of it. That happened long ago in the verses that we just read from at the beginning of this session. Today, we covet the pearl, but we are unwilling to support the irritation, the burning nucleus. And our spiritual life today has the exact consistency of an unclean oyster, and it stinks to heaven. We cannot face heaven. We have lost our genius for the vertical. Jewish novelists are sociologists, horizontalists, and the residue of energy from that great vertical seizure we had 4,000 years ago, that we turn toward ourselves. We knock on our own doors and wonder that no one answers. For many good historical reasons, Western Judaism, specifically in Western Europe, went through a thoroughgoing process of rationalization, of assimilation, acculturation, and because for the Reform movement to want to integrate its Jewish members into polite Western society, Western Christian society, that meant that all of that exoteric mysticism that has been part of everyday Judaism for so long was something that could not be tolerated. It was something that had to be relegated to the wastebasket of history. If we were going to be like our good Protestant neighbors. And so the practices of Hasidut and Kabbalah, the ideas about the immanence and the transcendence of God all at once, the practices which could help us become more in contact more of the time through our religious practices, through our spiritual work, was something that was not talked about and not dealt with, and was then kind of left for people who then were going to then identify as Orthodox later. And so the reform revolution was that of kind of this thoroughgoing removal of mysticism from Jewish life. And so that is what he talks about here, Leonard Cohen, is that we can feel the warmth of that moment, but we don't want anything to do with it. Rather, we turn our focus inward and not how we can become more in contact with that sense of unity, that sense of that positive feeling, of the sense of terror and awe that might be part of the divine encounter. But it is something about community, or it's something about being a good person or doing good deeds, and not necessarily about having an overwhelming spiritual experience because of the work that we do inside and outside of the synagogue. So not only do we need to come back in touch with the texts, the modes of practice, to begin experimenting again with these concepts and ideas, not only in Jewish renewal or in Hasidism or in the Haredi community, not only for the communities who have never let go of these traditions, Jews from Yemen, from Eastern lands, from Arab lands, but all Jews need to get to know their spiritual heritage. What that means is then we also need to be preparing Jewish guides for not only for these psychedelic experiences when they become more commonplace, but for when we can explore these mystical states of consciousness even without the use of drugs. There are breathing techniques, meditation techniques, rhythm and body movement techniques that can bring us to these places. But we have to know, first of all, what we need to do to prepare, what it is like when we actually get there, and then how we bring these experiences, drugs or otherwise, into our waking consciousness. So Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who was far beyond most people, most religious leaders, Jewish leaders even today. He saw this in 1964 after he had taken his first hit of LSD with Timothy Leary, and writing about his experience on that day at the very end of his write-up of this entitled The Aliyat HaNeshama, Aliyat HaNeshama and the LSD Experience. He said, "We need to train Jewish spiritual directors in the LSD experience. Put our texts to use. What I would want to do if I had the opportunity again is to control it in the shtiebel, the prayer setting space, with more of a Jewish paraphernalia, music, pictures, space arrangement. But I would also want to have someone who is going to be the ground control, to keep on calling attention to some Jewish program, because LSD took a hold of me and I had nothing to do with it," right? He kind of forgot what he had done, all of this preparation. And then as soon as the LSD hit, he says that he kind of forgot about what he was doing. Although if you read his trip report, he's having a deeply Jewish experience, a deeply profound Hasidic experience, because he can't escape who he is, coming from Chabad as he did. So he would want to make a sacrament out of it, to be administered as it were in shul under given situations with certain things. Next March, I hope to become the first rabbinic psychedelic assisted therapist. I'm going to be attending the California Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco, California, and be doing a year-long training program where I'm going to be learning about how to be a guide in the settings that Reb Zalman is talking about and the settings that I found myself in, and to be doing exactly what Reb Zalman hoped for, to eventually, when these therapies become available to more people and people who want to make it a particularly Jewish experience, whether they're Jewish or otherwise, to then have the training in these modalities and then to create a Jewish environment of preparation, looking at some of our most profound Jewish texts that talk about the mystical experience, the being in touch with the beyond, what it's like to explore in a Jewish context, and then how do we integrate Jewishly? How do we make Jewish decisions because of these psychedelic experiences that we have? I really just want to say this as well, that these things, as I have mentioned in the clinical model, they do have the power to help us heal our deepest wounds. These substances I've mentioned in indigenous and native cultures were primarily used for healing. We're seeing so much about PTSD and depression, either MDMA and psilocybin. And so for a people who have been profoundly impacted by trauma, by violence, by suffering throughout thousands of years that is passed through our DNA, that is passed through our genetics, what potential might this have for generational trauma and the relief of generational trauma for the Jewish people? This is all to say that I do believe not only can this help us rekindle the mystical heart of our religion, get us to know deeper about our spiritual heritage, to heal our deepest wounds, but maybe, just maybe, something closer to what the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, said would be the redemption of the world. And this is in his own Aliyat HaNeshama, in his own soul ascension, he said that he visited the Messiah in the Messiah's palace. And he asked the Messiah, he said, "When will the Master," meaning you, the Mashiach, "come?" And he answered, "By this you shall know. In the time when your teaching, you, the Baal Shem Tov, will become public and revealed in the world, and your wellsprings will burst forth to the farthest extremes, that which I have taught you and you have comprehended, and they also shall be able to perform unifications and elevations as you. And then all of the klipot, all of those outer husks, the things that we don't find to be bringing us closer to connection and spirituality, but the things that we think are drawing our power and bringing us farther away to our own most held beliefs and deep goals, they will cease to exist. And there shall be a time of goodwill and salvation." So if we can all ascend to the level of the Baal Shem Tov, maybe potentially by means of these substances, these plants and fungi, if we can become this God-aware, this divinely intoxicated, and to become like the Baal Shem Tov, perhaps there can be redemption, not just of the Jewish people, but all people, by coming closer to the divine that is within each and every one of us and acknowledging the divine in others as well. We should probably have many more episodes just to talk about this because there is so much, and I want to make sure people have a sufficient background, but also then get a little bit about where I'm going with my work. So I want to just say thank you. Thank you for the people who have continued to listen. I'm sure people have their own experiences. People have their own opinions about some of the things that I shared. But I just want to say thank you for being here, and take good care, everybody.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Rabbi Zach Kamenetz, speaking on psychedelics and the future of Judaism. To learn more about his work, go to zachkamenetz.com. We'll also provide information and a link at kalw.org/Bina. Lily Ray recorded today's program. I'm David Kwan, the editor and producer, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by a Rushanim trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.